Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Friday, April 5th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, lawmakers want to redefine what is illegal ballot harvesting in the state. Then the federal government steps in to help Jackson with policies to notify next of kin after a death. Plus, a descendant of Ida B. Wells shares how she's trying to keep her great-grandmother's legacy alive. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Mississippi lawmakers are nearing the finish line for a bill to redefine what constitutes ballot harvesting. It replaces a measure shot down by a federal court last year. Senate Bill 2425 would restrict the ability of third parties to collect and deliver another person's mail-in absentee ballot. Last year, arguments were made in the legislature. Nefarious parties are able to visit people at their homes or long-term care facilities, get them to fill out a ballot, and change or purge votes before they're mailed in. Judges ruled the law was too broad and would make it more difficult for people homebound or in long-term care facilities to vote in federal court. This new bill carves out more exceptions, such as for caregivers, household members, family, election officials, and postal workers. Democratic Representative Omaria Scott of Laurel tells our Was Stribling she still has concerns about the measure being too broad.
We have a lot of people in this state who have belonged to churches, and they have people that come in from the church because they are shut in, and they help them to get their ballots. These are folks that come to visit them. They're not family members. They're not household members. They're not caregivers. They're just friends. And so I'm afraid that because of these people being named like these categories being named like they are, that would leave out what I would call a Good Samaritan. And, you know, we have Good Samaritan language in a lot of bills that indemnifies people and it keeps them from being held, they're held harmless, and it keeps them from being subject to being arrested or indicted or put in jail. And we've seen innocent people, this happened to innocent people. So this bill really does not clarify that for me. Now, it does talk about who can assist a person to vote. But see, these are two different things. The getting of the procuring of the absentee ballot, the mail-in ballot, is one thing. And then the assisting of the person is something altogether different. And it would seem to me that if we have confidence in the person who is going to assist them, why not have that same confidence and let that person assist them in getting that ballot mailed to them? Because what we allow in assisting them, if that person is blind or if that person is disabled, which the people that I was talking about, my sick and shut-in, people that are in my churches all around my district, they would qualify for that, and a person could assist them, even with their choice in voting. According to this amendment that they brought did. But if they were to try to assist them in procuring their application and then procuring their ballot, they have to be a caregiver. They have to be a member of the household, or they have to be a family member. And I just think that we should have had something in there that would have allowed for a person of the voter's choice, like we do for assisting the individual to actually vote.
The representative that was presenting the bill said that he believed that their widening of the caregiver definition covered that stuff. Someone in that example who's helping out someone that's in their church family.
It does not, because the bill says that a caregiver means an individual who provides medical, health care assistance, or other assistance to the person to whom the ballot was mailed in the residence, in the hospital, in the long-term care facility, nursing home, hospice facility, assisted living, and what have you. The problem is this language of other assistance. And so it is broad, but it is also very narrow, and it is subject to interpretation. So if a district attorney interprets it to be one thing, particularly something that is much more punitive, then even though it says other assistance, it doesn't specifically say who that person can be. If they wanted to make it more clearer, it should have been voter's choice, like they did in the other amendment. So that the caregiver could be a person who provides all this stuff, all of these things, or other assistance by a voter's choice, by that person's choice.
I know that a strike all amendment was also adopted, so this will be going to conference. So is that what you hope to see, Good Samaritan language added to a final version of the bill during that process?
I think it would enhance this. If it becomes law, it would make it much better, because it would not be so punitive. You know, it was very disturbing to me when I saw that elderly black woman in Florida being handcuffed because she had voted thinking that she could. It was disturbing to me when I saw another elderly person, I believe they were in Texas, who was handcuffed because they said that they were being indicted for voter harvesting of ballots, when they were doing what they had always done, just gone out and assisted people. And with this proposal that we have does allow for them to even assist the people to vote. What I don't understand about it is that it doesn't give that same broad range to allow that person to say, I want Sue or Jane to come and assist me to get my absentee ballot. I don't understand that. I can't make it make sense.
Yeah, and we saw during the federal court case over a similar bill last year that the state couldn't present any evidence of ballot harvesting being done in the way that lawmakers say they fear that it would happen, that it would be folks affiliated with campaigns taking advantage of the elderly or otherwise vulnerable people and unduly influencing their vote. So what do you think about lawmakers legislating against something that there isn't any evidence of it happening in Mississippi, and then in that process could have unintended consequences like those examples that you gave?
Well, it seems to me that this is par for the course here for this legislature and for the state of Mississippi. We always are looking for a problem that is not there to solve, but the problems that we have that we need to be addressing to solve, we ignore those. Now, if we were serious about our business, we've had the largest scandal in the history of mankind with that DHS, almost $200 million being stolen. You know it was bad if the United States Congress has convened through their reform committee actions to be taken to look to make sure that this kind of scandal, and Mississippi is referenced, does not happen again. So we ought to be trying to solve the problems that we have as opposed to trying to look for something to solve. But that seems to be the case really these last 12 years. When you think about the things that we have pursued, and when you think about the millions of dollars that have been spent on frivolous lawsuits that the state has chosen to associate itself with, and then chosen to fight, and then lost, and then we've had to pay. So it is my hope that this will not be yet another frivolous action that the state takes, and, you know, we end up in court and we end up losing and we end up spending more money, millions of dollars that we need for the people of the state of Mississippi.
That's Democratic Representative Omaria Scott of Laurel speaking on Senate Bill 2425. Coming up, the Department of Justice steps in to help Jackson improve policies to notify next of kin of a death. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Autocorrect on MPB Think Radio, helping you correct your auto problems. Our host is Coach Charlie Melton, ASC Certified Master Technician.
Let me help save you some money working on your cars. Listen to our podcast, Autocorrect.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pohl Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Said. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
What can you do with the MPB radio app? Listen live, hear local news, view the schedule, make a contribution, listen to shows on demand, and interact with social media. Get the app for your smartphone now.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. The City of Jackson and Hinds County have just announced a partnership with the U.S. Department of Justice to improve the next of kin notification process. A media story last year found that a mother was never notified after her son, 37-year-old Jackson resident Dexter Waite, was struck and killed by an off-duty police officer's vehicle. Soon after, it was uncovered Waite wasn't the only person whose family wasn't notified properly that the media became aware of and shared that were buried in a pauper cemetery in Hinds County. City of Jackson spokeswoman Melissa Faith Payne says they've been working to improve their policies, and now she talks with our Mike McEwen about the U.S. Department of Justice stepping in to help with that process.
The City of Jackson, Chief Waite, actually, a few months ago, kind of sat down with his top brass anyway to kind of revamp JPD's next of kin policy. And what they've done is they've just made it more so that people in the department are accountable. There's more of a checks and balances situation in place now, so that when it comes to notification, it just ensures that officers have made every effort, and each step of the way that case is elevated up all the way to the chief, so that those next of kin notifications just don't fall through the cracks. As far as the collaboration with JPD, back in February, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights met with the mayor to talk about the importance of strengthening this policy, and the mayor connected them with the police department, and they've been working in lockstep since then to just kind of providing some feedback to JPD on their general orders, and do it. They'll do some training with the JPD officers related to this next of kin notification.
And my understanding is that there's a bit of a checks and balances revamp in part of the process of updating that policy. Could you just walk me through that?
I don't have a policy right in front of me, but I know that the way the new policy works, these departments have to work in lockstep. So if you have somebody from missing persons, would have to reach out to another department. And then once that department gets this notification that there is a death, then that department is tasked with reaching out to another department to ensure that somebody has reached out to the victim's family. I don't even know that there's even a way to close those cases until the family is notified, but it's escalated on each level. So it may start off, you know, with one of the sergeants, and then once they've taken steps there, if the next of kin has not been notified, then it's elevated to a captain. If the next of kin hasn't been notified, then it's elevated on up to one of the assistant chiefs. If that person still haven't notify the next of kin. It goes all the way until it makes it to the chief's office. And of course, none of them want it to make it to the chief's office. So that really empowers those officers to make sure that they make those notifications.
And was that decision, did that come before the Assistant Attorney General traveled to Jackson, or was that after some collaboration and discussion with her?
That was before. So we had already, those things were already in place prior to the Assistant Attorney General speaking with the mayor.
Now that they've made the official announcement, they mentioned some technical support. What does that look like exactly?
I think that there is an MOU, so a memorandum of agreement. That's one of the recommendations. So that if there's a death that maybe came from another jurisdiction, JPD, and the death maybe happened in Jackson, but maybe the victim lives somewhere else, just an MOU to make sure that Jackson is working with other cities and other entities to ensure that that happens. I know that there are other things that will go into place, but it would be constant support from the Department of Justice to make sure that JPD is doing what it needs to do. And the DOJ would also provide some feedback to Jackson Police. And we welcome it. I mean, the city is welcoming it. Our legal team is welcoming it. The mayor's office certainly welcomes it, because all of this at the end of the day is only going to help our residents.
Something that's come to mind for me in the past couple of days, there's obviously the announcement yesterday that the Violent Crime Initiative was being expanded to Jackson. Now there's this. Is it kind of a new chapter for the DOJ in the metro area, where it's not necessarily like looking into cases of police abuse or malfeasance, but instead trying to work with the police department to try and improve some systemic issues?
That, you know, I kind of feel like it's all about that. You know, we've been working with Capitol Police, you know, in that unified task force where we're working with them to combat weapons on the street, drugs on the street, and these violent offenders on the street. So this is just another chapter. And it's good that everybody is at the table together. These collaborations are welcomed. The Jackson Police, they're only as good as the city that they serve, and the residents need to feel safe. And these added efforts are welcomed. And again, it's a good thing when you can reach out to the chief and offer your assistance, and the chief willingly accepts it. Especially when it can only enhance the things that the chief has already put in place. So, again, these efforts really help the residents and help to boost confidence in the city of Jackson.
That's Melissa Faith Payne, spokesperson for the city of Jackson. Coming up, a descendant of Ida B. Wells shares how she's trying to keep her great-grandmother's legacy alive. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
If you aren't near a radio, you can still listen to MPB Think Radio and MPB Music Radio. You can download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone or listen online at mpbonline.org.
What can you do with the MPB Radio app? Listen live, hear local news, view the schedule, make a contribution, listen to shows on demand, and interact with social media. Get the app for your smartphone now.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pohl Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Said. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. The great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells is sharing her family's story and the efforts it takes to keep those memories alive. Michelle Duster is an author of two books. She's also a public historian and civil rights activist. She recently hosted a workshop at Jackson State University where she spoke with students about the importance of sharing accurate historical records and promoting equality. Duster says her great-grandmother used journalism to push for a more fair society, fighting for women's suffrage and civil rights for African Americans. Her family has been working to protect that legacy for years. Now she wants to share the skill of historical preservation with others.
I grew up in the family, that descended from Ida B. Wells, as well as I'm related to Ida B. Wells on my father's side of the family. But I also have a mother's side of the family. that had an influence on me were landowners, farmers. And so between the two sides of the family, the values that were passed down to me were self-determination, historical pride, and value of speaking up for your rights and believing that we're American citizens and we deserve first class citizenship. And so I grew up with, well, my mother's an educator. My father worked for the city for a long time. And so I grew up in an environment that was very politically and socially conscious, highly valued education, and like I said, self-determination.
Well, Ida B. Wells being well known, what is it that of her work, if anything, really affected you and brought you to the point where you wanted to be an educator and a historian?
Since Ida B. Wells is the focus of, I guess, all of my family members, her legacy inspired me as far as being willing to take on truth, sort of taking control of the narrative and exposing truth to power and using the power of the word to combat false narratives and to sort of hold a mirror. I mean, that's what she was doing. She was holding a mirror to the establishment of this country and using facts, indisputable facts, in order to build a case for public opinion, in order to affect change.
In your own experience with oral history, can you tell us a little bit about what you've done?
Well, I mean, I've interviewed, you know, several members of my family in order to gather family history in order to document it. And I've also, here in Chicago, there was a housing community named after Ida B. Wells, and which has been torn down. And in order to preserve that history of that community, there's been a need to interview former residents of that housing community to, you know, get the stories of the people who actually live there. Because, again, there's a lot of emphasis on the negative when it comes to sort of the mainstream narrative of that particular community. And there's a lot of positive stories that sort of get buried and pushed aside or marginalized. And I think it's important to tell the stories of joy and triumph and strength in the midst of, you know, some of the other realities. But, you know, the negative tends to be more uplifted by certain media outlets.
How do you save the material? Because it's so easy to lose track of what you've collected and put together. Do you have a way to teach folks how to save the material and store it?
Well, I mean, in my situation, when it comes to my great-grandmother, since she is a public figure, was a public figure, very well known during her time, I'm fortunate because, well, her papers and her documents are in a professional archive at the University of Chicago, which, you know, we could never preserve, you know, papers from 130 years ago in our basement because, you know, you need temperature control. You know, acid-free sort of paper and all. I mean, there's a lot of technical ways or materials that are needed in order to make sure that things, you know, stay preserved. So I would suggest if people, obviously most people don't have that, including myself. I mean, I don't have that capability in my house to do that. So probably the best way would be at this point to scan everything. And, you know, and have it as a JPEG or a PDF or something like that. And then there's no way that it would disintegrate. Or just take pictures and have JPEGs, you know, things like that.
All right. Well, Michelle Duster, a public historian, author, and great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.